From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Next on this morning's forum, the news is filled with stories about wars, terrorists, kidnappings, and hate crimes. But Michael Shermer, founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine, argues that things are much better than they appear. And in his new book, The Moral Arc, he claims that as science and technology progress, so too does our morality. Shermer's other books include The Believing Brain and Why Darwin Matters. He'll join us in studio for the hour ahead. That's after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of this morning's forum program. Michael Shermer joins us in studio for this forum hour, the founding publisher of Skeptic Magazine and the editor of Skeptic.com. He's also a monthly columnist for Scientific American and presidential fellow at Chapman University and the author of a number of books, including The Believing Brain and Why People Believe Weird Things. And his newest book is The Moral Arc, How Science and Reason Lead Humanity Toward Truth, Justice, and Freedom. And we welcome him to Forum.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And I should say, by way also of introduction, that this is a book that takes us through a major paradigm shift, which begins with the Enlightenment and the Age of Reason, begins with Galileo and Newton laying the groundwork. And here we are in, well, a moral age, as you see it, or at least moving into perhaps the dawn of a more moral age. We keep coming back, in my mind, to that quote of Martin Luther King's that was appropriated by our President Barack Obama, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." And in your judgment, it's got nothing to do with what Martin Luther King might have meant, divine justice.
Well, that's right. Although even King, in his autobiography, said his most influential sources were Gandhi and the most liberal of theologians that who invoked rights language from the Enlightenment, not biblical language from holy books. And King, by the way, got that that quote from a 19th century abolitionist preacher named Theodore Parker, who said of the moral universe that he looked out on, "My eye sees but little ways. I can barely discern the curve, but from what I can tell, it bends towards justice." And so that's where that quote comes from. It's a beautiful one. It's, you know, the film Selma is out now, and that's about that famous march, and that's where he gave that speech on the right in front of the steps of the Montgomery Capitol, and it was rattling off various rhetorical questions that he answered then not long. So, and I think we're there. I think we don't need divine conscience. We can get it through science and data. We should follow the trend lines, not the headlines. If you just follow the headlines, it seems like things are bad and getting worse. But if you follow the trend lines, as I do in The Moral Arc, it really does bend toward justice and freedom and liberty and prosperity and so on. There's really never been a better time, at least in the Western world for sure, to be alive, but almost anywhere on Earth. You know, slavery is abolished. It's illegal in every state in the world. It's still practiced in the form of, you know, sex trafficking and slave labor here and there. But we don't have to fight the legal battle anymore. That's been won. No one's arguing slavery should be legalized. And women have the franchise in every country on Earth except for Saudi Arabia and the Vatican, if you count that. So no one needs to make the argument that women should be able to vote anymore. And you know, civil rights, civil liberties, women's rights, gay rights, same-sex marriage, animal rights. I track all these in The Moral Arc and show that in every case it's getting better and better.
This also ties in terms of the diminution of violence. If you sort of subtract the headlines, as you suggest, it bleeds, it leads type of thing, with the book that Steven Pinker did, The Better Angels of Our Nature, the notion that we're getting better. And yet, I mean, Pinker has some numbers. He really crunches a lot of numbers here. And yet, scientifically and empirically, it's hard to prove, I suppose, for many people's lights, that you can connect this cause and effect to democracy and secularism and scientific rationality.
Well, this is what social scientists do for a living, is they attempt to tease out causal variables by controlling for other intervening variables and see what effects remain. So, for example, two political scientists crunched the numbers to test Immanuel Kant's theory that democracies are less likely to fight than other forms of government. So this is called the democratic diplomatic peace theory. It's you know, been debated for decades by political scientists and tested by lots of them. But Bruce Russett and Russett and O'Neill, in their book Triangulating Peace, showed that Kant was right, that there's three major factors to the decline of interstate conflict: having a democracy, democracies are less likely to fight one another, having international trade or economic interdependence between one another, and then the third one is membership in intergovernmental organizations. That is sort of transparency, that somebody's watching the watchers. And all of those combined basically make it less likely to conflict because citizens, it's in the citizens' best interest not to have go to war because it doesn't really pay off for citizens. It only pays off for politicians and state leaders. So, you know, who wants to do that? So they're less likely to vote for a war, for example. Not impossible. It happens, but less likely. And then the economic interdependence, you know, people are better off alive than dead if we can trade with them. So, for example, Canada has a lot of nickel. We could invade Canada and just take it. It's a, you know, wide open border. We could just march our troops across there. But it's a lot cheaper and nicer to just buy it. And it's more economically rational and feasible.
We go to war with the Keystone Pipeline too, but we're not doing that.
We're not going to do that
with Canada.
I mean, wars are super expensive. Just look at Afghanistan and Iraq. It's probably going to be upwards of $3 trillion by the time we're done paying for those wars. That's a lot of money to spend. And you know, what did we get for it? So the general feeling is that war is not good for the economy.
It's a rational deduction as you present it. But then you also talk about corroborating Kant. Difference between hard science and soft science, right? I mean, don't we have to cause that kind of bifurcation?
Well, if anything, I think the social sciences are the hard sciences. I mean, there's way more intervening variables than physicists and biologists have to deal with. So if anything, we have the harder problem. So we should call the social sciences the hard sciences because they are, like explaining consciousness, explaining the economy, explaining, you know, political states and how they operate. That's really a hard problem. So that's what we're trying to get here at the Moral Arc, Steve Pinker's The Better Angels of Our Nature. There's other books too. You know, there's I'm not the only one.
Well, you're with Kevin Kelly, the founder of Wired Magazine, who talks about protopia. I mean, there's a lot of the notion that we survive and that we move forward and become more moral because we want to keep ourselves intact as sentient beings, their self-interest and all that, and also want to save lives. There's a kind of morality of this, of science being for the common good and democratic values.
I think so, yes. One of the things that appeals to me about science is that it's not just an elitist club. Anybody can participate. It's true you have to get the union card, so to speak. You have to go to school and get training and a particular field of science, but there's no restrictions to it. You know, anybody can participate, and lots of people don't even go to school and get the degrees. They participate anyway. So that's the beauty of it. But in general, what I'm saying is that ever since the Enlightenment, scholars in various social fields, what we would call economics, political science, sociology, psychology, they didn't call it that back then, but they self-consciously patterned themselves after the scientific revolutionaries like Galileo and Newton and said, I want to do what Galileo and Newton did in the social sphere, starting with Thomas Hobbes and his influential book, The Leviathan. It's considered the most important political tract ever written. And he says right there, I am modeling myself after Galileo. And by which he meant that the world is governed by knowable laws and principles that we can, as rational beings, understand and then apply them to change the world, to make it better. And that was the whole point. Now, of course, he ends up with a government at the end of the book that most of us wouldn't want to live under, but he was defending the monarchy at the time. But the principle of applying reason and science to solving social problems, that has is what we've been doing for centuries.
I also remember from Leviathan, that famous line of Hobbes, we are a span from womb to tomb, which sounds pretty existential to my way of thinking or to my particular consciousness. But you say there's really good reason for morality being seen optimistically and being seen in a sanguine way, and this is a more moral time, minority, women, gays, all of that, crime is down, and we're just better at rights and freedom. You mentioned James Flynn in your work, who is given us a lot about abstract reasoning and pretty much sets up this scale that shows that IQ has been going up a couple points almost every decade. And with better abstract reasoning, we become more empathic. We become maybe more utilitarian in the Bentham or John Stuart Mill's way of recognizing the best for the most and all of that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But so much of this depends upon science as you see it. And, of course, you get into that argument rather strongly and make the argument in a very well-supported way. But I'm sure people have come back to you and said, well, science, because you've written a lot and debated a lot about the Holocaust, I know. There was science at Auschwitz with Dr. Mengele. There's science in nuclear weapons. There's science in government surveillance. These are things that are not necessarily leading us into moral.
That's true. It's you know, I get that pretty much every interview I give, and that's fine. But what I'm talking about,
am I just giving you a duplicate of what you get?
No. It's a very good point. It's a valid objection. But my point is that like the Nazi regime, just take that for example, the belief that there were inferior races. And that Jews were the backstabbers who caused the First World War and caused Germany to lose the First World War. Those are just errors in thinking. They were just wrong. They, you know, the eugenics program was pseudoscience, not science. And the whole Nazi regime was based on an anti-Enlightenment romanticism notion of blood and soil and race and a superior race. And the Ukraine and all that belongs to us because that's our soil, the blood of our people. Or you know, it's all this really sort of metaphysical, supernatural, just crazy, illogical, unscientific notions that was driving that. And people don't drop atomic bombs or not because of science. They, you know, these are political decisions. But let me point out that no one's dropped a bomb since August of 1945. It hasn't happened in a conflict of any kind. And so the question is why? And the answer is because governments are becoming more rational at calculating how we can prevent those sorts of things. The entire Cold War was one long game theory analysis on how to avoid falling into that trap. I mean, the whole Kennedy Khrushchev, standoff in the Cuban Missile Crisis was exactly a game theory analysis played out in the real world to show how to avoid it. That's a completely rational, scientific way of going about solving social problems.
Oh, we also saw what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We were in mutual assured destruction mode. I mean, we knew that certainly where Russia was concerned.
But in the case of that, dropping the bombs, the goal was not to exterminate the Japanese people. The goal was to end the war, and it ended the war, and the moment the war was over, the killing stopped. That's a completely different thing than states have been doing for the previous 500 years, which was to just exterminate the other people almost entirely.
Which is what ISIS wants to do. I mean, and they've been burning books. They've been doing pretty much what the Nazis did. They want to purify. We learned from this German journalist who was embedded with them. They literally want to kill millions because these are non-believers. This includes other Muslim, Shia, and so forth and so on. Now, is that because of religion? Is that because they're behind in science, behind in democracy?
That's because branches of the Islamic faith have not gone through the Enlightenment. I mean, Christianity and Judaism, if you look back at the history, look at the Old Testament, look at the Christianity in the Middle Ages, they were just as barbaric as these Islamic extremists.
As you like to point out, they were burning witches because it said in Leviticus, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live.
Right. I mean, but Judaism and Christianity went through the Enlightenment. They came out the other side peaceful and rational and making arguments like, you know, all people should be treated equally under the law and that all people should have equal opportunities and that, people should never be treated as a means to an end but an end in and of themselves. Those ideas are Enlightenment ideas. They came from Immanuel Kant and John Locke, not from the biblical ancestors.
And what about things that you've said, like you think this is going to move along this arc and poverty will be gone by 2050 when we factor in what we know about climate change and what's happening just scientifically in terms of all the destruction that's potential with climate change?
Yeah, the Gates Foundation is projecting the end of poverty by somewhere between 2030 and 2050. It's happening very fast, as defined by the UN, that making under $1.25 a day, extreme poverty, and making under $2.50 a day is regular poverty. By that definition, that kind of poverty will be eradicated. Now, it's true making $5 a day is, you know, not exactly being prosperous, but it's, you know, it's better than it was. And those kinds of projections we can make. Of course, they don't have to happen. I mean, things can be set back temporarily. But my point is that in the long run, the curves keep bending. That arc keeps bending. I mean, just picture, would you imagine any state of the United States, say, deciding that women should no longer have the right to vote, or the Supreme Court voting to, overturn the 19th Amendment and take the vote back from women. No, this is never going to happen. And the same thing with same-sex marriage. Once this gets passed, it's not going to reverse. It's just very, very unlikely. And we're in the middle of that revolution right now. We can see what's happening. You can see who opposes it. All the fundamentalist religions have opposed gay same-sex marriage from the beginning. And only now, just like this year, are they starting to change. And I predict that by 2020, this debate will be just like the interracial marriage debate was in the 50s and 60s. Remember when people did not approve of interracial marriage? Yeah, me neither. I mean, what? I mean, are you serious? Yes, they did. In 1959, only 4% of Americans approved of interracial marriage. Now, no one even talks about it. It's just like, are you kidding? What were they thinking back then?
Well, it depends on what state you're in and all that, you know, in terms of disapproval.
Maybe privately some people do. But even that's a sign of moral progress. Like Donald Sterling down in L.A. where I'm from, you know, in private to his mistress, disparages African-Americans coming to the Clippers games. And for this, he's heaped with scorn and has to sell his team. Back in the 50s, most old guys thought like that, and they weren't especially private about it. You know, that's how far we've come.
Talking to Michael Shermer, his new book is The Moral Arc, How Science and Reason Lead Humanity Toward Truth, Justice, and Freedom. Much of your whole career, really, has been established and built on skepticism. I mean, you've been associated with skeptic.com and have
Skeptic
written
magazine,
about skepticism,
yep.
Have a magazine and so forth. And yet there is and you just use these words about religion, metaphysical and unnatural and illogical. And those words kind of go together when you're talking about UFOs or religion or just anything that skeptics look at with skepticism. I was wondering, though, because there was a story that you told about your wife's having a transistor radio.
Oh, yes.
And she got the transistor radio from her grandfather. It didn't work. Suddenly you're getting married. And you said it shook your skepticism to the core. Something happened that was completely irrational.
I did, yes. It was quite an experience. On the day of our wedding at our home in Southern California, my wife's from Germany, Cologne, Germany, and Jennifer was sort of feeling bad that she didn't have any family there, you know, 9,000 miles away from home and friends and family, kind of wishing she had some connection to her family. And this dead radio that I had been trying to fix, you know, when she shipped it over to me months before and I couldn't fix, we just threw it in the back of a drawer in our desk drawer in our bedroom and, you know, it was just dead. And then all of a sudden it comes alive at that very moment that she was thinking that. And when we had gone back there to just have a private moment to ourselves with our guests in the other room and just before we were going to do everything and boom, there it was. Music was playing and it played the rest of the day and night and then stopped the next morning and hasn't played since, despite my efforts to get it started again. Now, so I wrote about this in Scientific American and it is probably the most popular column in terms of people writing and making comments and passing it along and so on, because it's like Mr. Skeptic had a paranormal experience. Well, I had an experience. You know, what does it mean? For my wife, Jennifer, and I, it meant a lot. It was deeply emotional and very fulfilling, and we really appreciated that. You know, what does it mean scientifically or whatever? You know, nothing. You know, I can't comment and say that one experience means that, you know, the dead are on the other side, you know, connecting through radios or that the paranormal is real or that there is a God and an afterlife. None of that, because just weird things happen. So my point is, when weird things like that happen, just appreciate them for what they are and leave it at that.
Well, when somebody tells you, I actually have a whole chapter of this in a book of mine, but things that happen by serendipity or seem paranormal, there are people who say, you know, this has to be happening for a reason. There has to be some kind of rationality or force up there in the sky that's looking over us that's sort of dictating it. It's just too paranormal, too coincidental, too serendipity.
Well, everybody thinks that. All of us think that. Tend to think that things happen with relation to us. So there's called the self-serving bias that all of us tend to overestimate the likelihood that other people are talking about us or other people are looking at us or, you know, that things happen, you know, because of us. And then the general bias that things don't just happen for a reason. That is, we're not good at understanding chance and coincidences and accidents and things like that. When things happen, we automatically connect the dots. I call that patternicity, tendency to find meaningful patterns in random noise. We all do it. Our brains are wired to do that. It's called learning. It's called connecting the dots. That's okay. But the problem is sometimes chance just happens. Just stuff happens for no reason at all. And it's hard to get our minds around it, which is why we need science. This is what science does. Science has a specific method designed to tell the difference between real effects and chance. So if you have some drug for AIDS or cancer or whatever, you can't just declare that it works, because the medical profession is going to say, we need to know if the effects you're claiming might have happened anyway by chance. Sometimes cancers just go into remission. Who knows why? You know, not everybody dies from AIDS. Who knows why? So, you know, so you can't just say that, you know, it's your drug that did it. It might be chance.
There's a local philosopher named Jacob Needleman who talks about empirical proof and non-empirical proof, as if inner light or inner consciousness or something along these lines, people who say this is so because I know I experienced it, and they tell you that.
Yes, but that's not scientific. The problem with it, I mean, I understand it. I have had those feelings too. And
with the transistor, you had that.
Yes, well, and other, you know, other experiences too. But that was a big one. But the problem of generalizing that to all beliefs is it doesn't help us any, because what about all the counterexamples? You know, people that are in need of some connection and nothing unusual happens. It's just like when that Asian plane went down a couple of weeks ago, and there was a family that was supposed to be Asian Airlines supposed to be on that flight, and they were late to the airport. I don't remember what happened, but they didn't get on the flight, and of course they're ecstatic. You know, they lived; everybody else died, and there they were on the news in the airport. You know, thanking Jesus, thanking God for saving them, and how Jesus is a loving God for saving them. Well, that's nice, but what about all the Christians and Jesus-loving people on the plane who died? How come Jesus didn't save them? How come he didn't delay their car ride to the airport? In other words, it's the counterexamples that go against the belief in the paranormal and the supernatural and God and the afterlife. It's, you know, all the people that, you know, died that didn't have near-death experiences. They didn't see Jesus. Jesus didn't save them from their cancer or whatever. It's the counterexamples that scientists call attention to and say, we need to study those.
And what about the counterexamples to the notion that we're moving along this moral arc? I mean, again, you know, there's an argument to be made that we've just avoided nuclear war by sheer luck. Eric Schlosser's book makes it seem like some of these chances.
Yes, I
came
read
so
Eric's
thin.
Book. It's a great book.
It's an extraordinary book. I mean, it scared the whatever out of you. But I'm just interested, though, in finding out your thoughts about this. When you pick up a newspaper, you know, it's like Brecht said, if the man who laughs has not yet been told the terrible news. I don't want to sound too skeptical, even beyond your skepticism, but the irrationality of human behavior, the extremes of human behavior, the violence that we read about day after day in the screaming headlines, which may not necessarily represent the biggest number crunchings, but are there.
It's true. It's not impossible that nuclear war could break out. It's just very unlikely compared to what it was 10 years ago, and less likely still compared to 20 years ago and 50 years ago, and so on. So something
even when proliferation is taking place. And
we've gone from a peak of 70,000 nuclear weapons in the mid 1980s to under 10,000 now. Each of the United States and Russia have less than 4,000 active.
Yeah, but we've got Pakistan, we've got India, we've got North Korea.
Yes, but why haven't Pakistan and India used their nuclear weapons? I mean, if anything, you would have thought those two would have gone at it already, but they haven't. So there's something of a growing taboo against using nuclear weapons and now even owning them.
Oh, I think it's not growing. It's there. But whether or not it can be kept to or adhered to. We're coming up on a break. We're going to get you out there involved in this conversation with Michael Shermer. Always fascinating conversation when he's on the program. But the whole theory here is science, reason, lead us toward truth, justice, and freedom. I almost said the American way. That's Superman. You can join us toll-free. 866-733-6786 is the number. 866-733-6786 or email forum@kqed.org. You're listening to Forum, and our guest is Michael Shermer, science writer and founder of the Skeptic Society and also founding philosopher of Skeptic Magazine. His new book is called The Moral Arc, How Science and Reason Lead Humanity Toward Truth, Justice, and Freedom. He's also the author of The Believing Brain and Why Darwin Matters. And we welcome your involvement in this program. You can join the conversation, and you can do that now. Our toll-free number is 866-733-6786 or email us forum@kqed.org or go to our website and you can post questions or comments there, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @kqedforum or go to our Facebook page. Many ways to communicate with us. Let's go to your calls and hear what you have to ask or say. Neil, you're on. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes. Actually, it's Scott, isn't it?
Apologies. Yeah, it's Scott. Listen, I'm really enjoying the conversation. I wanted to ask you, it seems like when you talk about things like nuclear weapons, women voting, slavery, all that stuff, those seem to be relatively low-hanging fruits for me, maybe just obvious. But I was wondering if you could expand on things that have emerged out of science or grounded in science that we don't have historical markers on. For example, you know, the rate at which we just consume here in the United States and in Europe, the growing pollution of the oceans, the things that are perhaps on a different arc that are also, you know, like, it seems like we're just looking at one side of the coin. I hope that makes sense.
Yep, makes perfect sense. You know, my book is already pretty long, so I didn't want to add another 15,000-word chapter on global warming and the environment. We've done a lot on that in Skeptic over the years, and I think it's real. Global warming is real. It's primarily human-caused. I think it's not clear whether it's going to be catastrophic or not. I don't think I don't think we can say doomsday is coming for sure. I think it's a problem we should be working on many different levels, technologically, scientifically, and politically. But I don't think it's the sort of thing that's going to bend the moral arc backwards. And in the long run, I think the solution is to get the population numbers down by 2100 to 2200, back down to a couple billion rather than up to 10 or 11 billion, where we're going to end up at about 2050 now. And the way to do that is to get most of these, mostly in Africa, to get these African countries prosperous, democratic, and especially get women more financial autonomy and prosperity, more education and access to birth control technologies. Because when you do that in other countries, historically, the trend has been for both birth rates to go down, the overall population birth rates to go down, and for you conservatives who are pro-life, for abortion rates to go down. If you want abortion rates to go down, you've really got to educate women and make them prosperous and give them access to birth control technologies. Here I'm talking mainly in Africa. So having things like the Pope and the Catholic Church forbid this, this is a big problem. That's one of those things we have to focus on.
There's also a lot of data that suggests that as a country becomes more democratic, more enlightened, to use I think the operative word here, it certainly is better for the environment as well as for reproductive rights.
That's right. You have to care about the environment. You have to already be at a certain level of prosperity. You know, if you don't have three square meals a day and you don't have a place to live, who cares about global warming? You know, so we got to get the Chinese up and through their industrial revolution fast, because you know why should they hold back since we've already done it? And then the African countries, again, just follow the Gates Foundation webpage. They have tons and tons of really good data showing how this is happening very quickly. All the rights revolutions are happening faster now than ever before, in part because of the internet, I think, but also perhaps an accelerating rate of change. And like same-sex marriage, the whole thing will be over probably this year, and attitudes will be completely changed for the most part by 2020 or so.
That's an important question online from a listener named Levi, who says, do we think that people in 2015 are thinking more often with their scientific brains? It seems the new age can also be one of isolation and selfishness. Can you talk about why the economic disparity in San Francisco and the world matters? Why would a measurable like that make sense in terms of morality? Why not talk about the more rational term, ethics? Why are we focusing on gay rights as a moral issue instead of an ethical, constitutional, logical 14th Amendment issue?
Wow, okay, there's a lot packed in. There's first of all, my book is called The Moral Arc, so I'm talking about morality. Ethics is the study of morality, so it's just a slight distinction on the use of the words, but that's okay. In terms of are we becoming more empathetic, we are, but that can cut both ways. I mean, if you're super empathetic for your fellow in-group members, it's easy to then demonize people who are not part of your in-group because you're so tightly knit with your fellow in-group members. And then and this is how genocides happen in part, that you know those people over there are harming us and we band of brothers have to stick together. You know, we're bonded. So empathy by itself is not the solution. The solution is to inhabit other people's brains that are different from you, that are not part of your in-group. So I have the metaphor of the expanding the expanding moral sphere, that we're incorporating more and more people into our sphere who are not like us, who are not part of our tribe, not part of our group. And that has come about in part because of the reading revolution, reading novels, the internet, travel, trade, openness to, you know, political, different political systems, all that. The EU is an example of reducing animosity between nations that used to be at war with each other constantly. You know, if you think about, you know, what the great powers were like for the last 500 years, they were always at war with each other. Two countries in Europe were always fighting all the way up till 1945, then it stopped. Imagine today the French army marching through the Channel into London. I mean, it's almost laughable. Well, what are you talking about? The French aren't going to fight the British. Why would they? Right. Why would they? But they have in the past. So something happened, and there's several factors.
They're fighting ISIS, which some – I mean, there are certainly wars, and not necessarily wars over resources, though if resources start to dwindle, we may find ourselves in that situation again. But there's
most wars are not
fighting going on everywhere. The French are – pretty much one of our allies, one of our major allies, which is causing a great deal of problems in France in terms of trying to hit them in ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
Now, let me get some more callers. I guess it gets into, again, that whole question of people drawn to rationality more and more, as opposed to people being, maybe by the nature of humankind, more irrational than we're giving them credit for.
I think people can reason their way to moral choices, and that, in fact, my central argument of the first chapter of my book is that we've already been doing this for centuries. That is, we've tried to structure our economy and our political systems on a rational basis. I mean, there's a reason that Jefferson kept referring to the American experiment and the American experiment in democracy, and that democracy is an experiment. What he meant was, in a really natural experimental way, that let's try different things and collect the data and then change the variables again and see how it goes. Those are called elections. And the point was that nobody knows how to run a country. You can't really do it from the top down like there's some divine king that knows the right answers for everybody, or like Plato's enlightened dictator sort of. That's not going to work.
Actually, Jefferson believed in a kind of democracy run by, well, not an aristocracy by blood, but an aristocracy of intelligence and humanity.
Yes, but he also supported public education. And he founded...
And slavery.
He didn't found slavery.
ISIS supported it, though.
Or he didn't resist.
Yeah, that's another nice way to put it.
Or the temptation with his slaves, too, as we know now. But he founded the University of Virginia. He supported public education. The idea is that we want rational voters. And the idea behind that is that people can actually reason their way to rational decisions if they have the facts correct.
We'll go to more of our calls. Let's bring Felicity on. Felicity, welcome.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I'm an intensive care nurse. I take care of many people that are dying and have sat with people, in their last moments. And I feel that whatever comforts people when they're leaving this world should be accepted. It's whether it's God, whether it's luck, whether it's chance, whether it's irrational, I think it's all, I don't want to say good, that's very simplistic, but whatever helps people make the transition out of this world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yes, on one level, I will agree that, whatever gets you through the night. I mean, life is tough. Stuff happens. Bad things happen. All of us are going to die, and most of us not pleasantly. So on one level, okay, whatever it takes. But on the other hand, there are rational ways to deal with death and dying, and there are lots and lots of secularists who go through this process with their families or themselves, who don't invoke God in the afterlife and so on, and they do just fine. And so it isn't necessary to have religion. And in any case, who would want to believe in a God simply because I'm afraid to die and I'm hoping that, there is a God and I'm going to go to heaven or whatever just because I'm afraid? I mean, wouldn't it be nice if it was actually true, if it's true, that there really is a God and there really is an afterlife? And wouldn't it be good to know if that was the case one way or the other, rather than just wanting it to be so? Because the problem is with human psychology, there's lots of things we would like to be true, but that doesn't make them true.
But she brings up, I think, a worthy point. If someone can get comfort at the end get comfort from what may be just metaphorical or who knows what, and maybe even part of them is denying the possibility and is skeptical about it. If they accept it and embrace it in order to get through the night, as you put it.
Uh-huh. Yep. I would never take that away from somebody. It's not my style to go in there and disrupt somebody's final time. I personally wouldn't tell a loved one that, they're going to heaven. I wouldn't do that. I haven't done that. I've lost all my parents and had four parents, two step-parents, two bio-parents, and was with two of them at the end. It's just I didn't offer that kind of hope. They weren't expecting it anyway.
You brought up Christian fundamentalists.
No, my family was not religious. I went through that in high school. It was a peer group influence. My peers were got into religion, and I did too. But I took it more seriously than most of them, and I went to Pepperdine to study theology at Pepperdine University. And Malibu is a Church of Christ. Church of Christ.
Oh, Church of Christ.
Yeah, it has sort of a Texas origins. But, you know, I got a lot out of it. It was a great, great experience. But in the long run, it wasn't for me.
Listener Ben writes, though I share your guest's optimism, how can he account for times in human history where humans have managed to go backward? For instance, the Dark Ages, the decline of the Egyptian Empire, and World War I.
Yes, so these are good examples. Most of the changes I'm tracking, though, are just over the last couple of centuries. Certainly the Roman Empire collapsing could happen again, say, to the United States. But it's just less likely to have the kinds of cascading consequences into a Dark Ages than it did then. There were just far fewer sources to keep the knowledge alive. Today, it would be almost impossible to eradicate all knowledge, essentially throwing us back to the Stone Age and starting over.
Especially, as you indicated before, with the Internet.
That's right. I mean, it's not impossible. My argument in the moral arc is not that this arc is inevitable from the Big Bang. It had to end up here, or since the Middle Ages, it had to end up where we are. No, it's not inevitable. But the further down the path we go, every year that we go without nuclear war makes it even less likely that it will happen. Not impossible, just less likely.
Here's Tom, who writes, Edward Gibbon's thesis in The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire was that the spread of Christianity undermined the social, political, and moral values that held Rome together. It's only recently that we've come to appreciate how advanced technology and scientific thinking were at the height of the empire. Does Mr. Shermer have a prescription for how our Enlightenment civilization can defend itself against the seemingly strengthening forces of irrationality, such as jihadism and other religious fundamentalisms? I think you've already kind of suggested it.
Yes. Well, we have to pay close attention to, Islamic extremism for sure. ISIS. I prefer calling them ISIL because ISIS implies they're a state. They're not a state. No terrorist group has ever overturned a state. So they're not an existential threat that way. They're not going to conquer France or Germany or England or the United States. It's not going to happen. And they certainly won't conquer
Just because
Israel.
They're not a state? They've conquered a lot of Iraq and Syria already, and they're not a state.
Well, that's right, but they won't. They won't establish a state. That will not happen. We won't let that happen.
Well, they call it a caliphate.
Yes, well, okay. And therein lies the problem, religion. Religion is the problem here. Not all religions. Fundamentalist religion based in bad ideas that lead to violence. That's the problem.
And the prescription is to try to rid the world of it?
Well, initially, we do have to have a strong military. I mean, it's unfortunate, but that's the world we live in. The world has walls, and on those walls are men with guns, and we have to face that fact. But in the long run, it's debunking bad ideas. Like many of the ideas in Sharia are bad ideas, you know, that women should be treated as second-class citizens or inferior to men, or women should not have the equal opportunity for education. These are bad ideas. These are illiberal, un-Western, unscientific, irrational ideas that need to be debunked no less than witchcraft was debunked centuries ago.
I've had Muslims on this program who said that's misinterpretation.
Okay,
of Sharia.
Fine. If it is, then they should debunk it. And they are. I know a lot of moderate Muslims are debunking those ideas. Good. Keep at it.
And here's Van. Van, thanks for waiting. You're on the air with us. Join us.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm wondering what the author thinks of the information we're learning from evolutionary psychology and how we're pre-wired for certain beliefs, especially in a social context, and, you know, how civilization is required to deal with those predispositions, and how we need to recognize that civilization needs to act as a counterpoint to some of those predispositions. And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, that's a really good question. Basically, as I argue in the first chapter of The Moral Arc, that we have a dual nature. We are good and evil. We are cooperative and competitive. We're greedy and we're selfless. We're helping and we're hurting. We have a dual nature. And the whole point of civilization, with a society with a rule of laws, is to attenuate the one and accentuate the other, to help disincentivize people from committing crimes and violence and incentivize them to be nice and cooperative and so on. And I use lots of research on this. I'll just give one example of a common goods game that behavioral economists like to play to see how people interact financially with each other. So four people are sitting around a table, and the experimenter gives each of them 10 $1 bills. And they're in the first round, they put into an envelope anonymously however much of the $10 that they want. However much ends up in the common pot, I, the experimenter, will multiply that total by 1.5 and redistribute the goods equally to everybody sitting at the table. So ideally, for example, if everybody puts in all 10 bucks, we have $40. I multiply by 1.5. We have 60 bucks divided by 4, $15. So I started with 10. Now I have 15. This is a great deal. We should all keep putting in all 10 bucks. Well, actually, when it's anonymous and there's no chance for punishing anybody for free riding or cheating the system a little bit or contributing lower numbers, what happens is that all of a sudden people start putting in a few dollars less. So maybe, you know, the next round I put in $5 and I hold $5 back and the rest of you put in $10. So I end up with, you know, $5 more than everybody else at the end of the game. And then, but it isn't long before everybody sees, wait a minute, somebody's holding back. I'm not going to put as much in the next round. And the whole thing collapses within half a dozen to a dozen rounds like that. Then this the scientist, Farron Gachter, who published this study, they added a second condition in which it was transparent how much everybody put in, and everybody could see how much everybody put in, and you're allowed to punish somebody who put in less if you didn't like that. All of a sudden, everybody became very generous and cooperative. So having rules, having transparency, this is what democracies are much better at than autocracies, that we want to know what's going on and who's acting fairly and who's cheating the system. And that way, when we know that, then people are more likely to be moral and cooperative. So to answer the caller's question, yes, a civil society with a rule of law is a democratic society. You know, we've got the variables down pretty good now after 2.5 centuries of experimentation.
Michael Shermer, here with us in studio, is the author of The Moral Arc. That's his new book, How Science and Reason Lead Humanity Toward Truth, Justice, and Freedom. He'll be appearing at Kepler's tonight, by the way, at 7 o'clock, and tomorrow at Book Passage, and Wednesday at Books, Inc., and we'll bring another caller on. And, Scott, that's you. Hi.
Hi. Morning. I have to respectfully disagree that The Moral Arc is improving, perhaps with the guest point about religious extremism or perversion of ideas. I would agree with that. However, I think that's missing the forest for the trees in the sense that since Nixon or Reagan or you pick one, the wealth gap is now the highest in history. I know I've had cancer more than a half dozen times trying to establish a survivorship program and volunteer at Stanford to do it, but for legal reasons, I guess I'm not allowed to do that. But the lawmakers, the policymakers at the very top of the society that set the rules and the laws that your guest is talking about are taking instruction from the corporations for which they work, not the people they represent.
Scott, I'm glad you brought that up because we just did a program on the Davos meetings, and what we learned from that is indeed the rich are getting richer and the poor getting poorer.
They are, right? Yes. In my final chapter of The Moral Arc called Protopia, you mentioned Kevin Kelly, he coined that word, meaning that utopias and dystopias are both unrealistic. Protopia is how it works, just slow, gradual progress, tiny in increments. Okay, so I do deal with income inequality. It's the other elephant in the room besides Islam.
And more corporate. Corporate power, which he brings up, which perhaps obviates the possibility of other people.
More corporate power in the political realm. That I will admit, is problematic. I don't mind that the Google guys and Apple and these companies make a lot of money. I mean, make all the money they want. Just keep
And what about the morality of using all the tax loopholes and using all that to essentially make sure that people and institutions who could be getting the money don't get the
money? Well, that's what laws are for. So if you don't like,
it's also what morality is for, isn't it?
That's right. Well, okay. So if the purpose of a corporation is to make a profit. Once you've incorporated, it's no longer you personally, although you as a CEO can influence it. But again, in a democracy, we should be able to change the laws if we don't like them, and we do. This happens all the time. I mean, corporations are reined in. There's all sorts of restrictions on corporations. They can't just do whatever they want. I mean, it may feel like they do, but they don't. Now, the income gap is real, okay? So the difference between the top 20% versus the rest of the 80% is significant over the last 30 years. The rich really have gotten richer. But note what has not happened. Those four quintiles below the top 20% have not gotten poorer. They've also gotten richer. They've just not gotten richer as fast as the richest have gotten rich. And so overall, we're all more prosperous than we used to be. I make far more money than, say, my father did in real dollars, adjusted for inflation and so on, at essentially the same, you know, middle class level that we're both at, just by dint of the entire tide has risen for all of us. So I think before we go down the road of let's take money away from those at the top, let's see if we can increase the bottom 80%, you know, the rest of us, even more than we already have. That would be my solution.
Here's John, who writes, I was a bit taken aback by the assertion that fewer nuclear weapons means less chance of nuclear war. This is a quantity versus quality issue. There may be fewer nuclear weapons, but they are in the possession of increasing unstable states, which in my mind is a new and extremely dangerous situation. Furthermore, it's alarming to me that the country is currently in the thrall of Chris Kyle of American Sniper fame. This is a man who is an admitted racist who gave vent to an insatiable bloodlust by admittedly killing innocent savages, as he called them, in order to maintain kill numbers when they were being challenged by another American sniper. And this man has become a national hero. What does this say about us?
Well, I'm not sure he's a national hero. He's a national debate. I mean, there's people on both sides of this. I saw the film. To me, it wasn't clearly a pro-American, let's go over there and kill brown people kind of film.
It could be seen as an anti-war film. I just want to remind listeners that you're listening to Forum. We're talking to Michael Shermer. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. And for more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. Go back to you on this, Michael Shermer.
Oh, yeah. So I was just saying I saw American Sniper. To me, it wasn't at all clear that it was a pro-American, let's go over to foreign countries and kill brown people kind of film at all. I think there were several parts in the film that clearly stated the other position, where, you know, his buddy is killed and his buddy's wife has this letter that he gives to his wife, and she asks him about this, you know, look at these things he said, what are we doing over here, what's the point of this war, and so on. So that's also in the film, I would point out. And I think it's good to have those kinds of debates. You know, it's all right. But in terms of the nuclear weapons, okay, so even right now I think each of the United States and Russia has about 4,400 active nuclear weapons. All right, that's still enough to really cause significant, huge, you know, catastrophic problems for us. But if we can get it below 1,000, which is where we're heading, I think by 2020 to 2025 or so we'll be below 1,000 active nuclear weapons, then it's unlikely we would get anything like a nuclear winter or a, you know, civilization ending war, and that's helpful. There's a group called, you know, there's actually about a dozen different Nuclear Zero groups, but the big one is Nuclear Zero. And this is endorsed by none other than people like Henry Kissinger, you know, one of the Cold Warriors himself, and Sam Nunn and
George Shultz.
George
here
Shultz.
In the Bay Area, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, these aren't, this isn't Peter, Paul, and Mary.
I was just having this conversation liberals, you know? Because a friend of mine, whom our listeners know, Phil Bronstein, who used to head up the Chronicle, did an interview with Eric Schlosser, who I also did an interview with some time back. And it's somewhat discouraging to see how little it seems to be on the radar screen these days. I mean, in terms of media coverage or just general citizenry awareness where it comes to nuclear.
Well, isn't that another weaponry sign of progress, that it's not impossible that nuclear weapons could be used in exchange? It's just so unlikely that we've now diverted our attention to other things like terrorism. But terrorism is nothing even remotely like the existential threat that nuclear weapons used to be. I mean, they used to be, say, in the 80s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, you know, that would be a civilization-ending exchange back then. And it isn't anymore, and that's why we don't talk about it. So that's another sign of moral progress.
Well, I like to think that way. I just think about ISIS with all ISIL, if you want, whatever you want to call it, all the money they have and possible connections to Pakistan and also you know, states that were former part of the USSR, Libya bought a bomb. It's very capable. Now Iran will have a bomb. I mean, it just seems to be proliferating.
I don't think Iran's going to get a bomb. If they do, it's going to be a while still.
Let me go to another caller. John, we're getting a little off base here. The book is really about the moral arc, not necessarily about nuclear weapons.
Although I have a section on
there is a section on it, though. Yeah. John, go ahead.
Is this John in Mill Valley?
John in Mill Valley is you, I believe,
okay, cool.
Yes.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, so my question relates to issues like abrupt climate change and mass extinction. You've mentioned nuclear war many times, but you've not mentioned these other issues, which scientists are raising as almost equally high-risk situations today or in the near term.
Yes, I think it's a fair point. One of the best books of 2014 is The Sixth Extinction by Elizabeth Culbert.
We featured here on Forum. It's in our archives. I just say that because you may want to go and listen
to
that.
Yeah, no, she's a terrific researcher and a good writer, and the book is important. And we may very well be in the middle of a sixth extinction. It is something that I'm concerned about. But in my chapter on animal rights, I show that we are becoming more sensitive to the well-being, the survival and flourishing of sentient beings, as I say in my starting point. I use sentient beings instead of people so that we can go ahead and include, throw into the moral sphere, you know, chimpanzees and gorillas and the other great apes, the marine mammals, dolphins, whales, and so on, and work our way through all the mammals. And concern about the biosphere and those sorts of things have never been more on our radar since the ecology movement began in the 70s. So, again, follow the trend lines, not the headlines. You know, there's a lot of progress even on that, even the awareness of it. And, of course, you know, there's this, this de-extinction movement that a lot of scientists are, optimistic about, bringing back the passenger pigeon and maybe even woolly mammoths. I don't know where you're going to put them, maybe Canada or something, but it's not impossible that we could bring back these extinct species. That's not the solution. The solution is quit killing them. But in the short run, at least we can do that.
Brings us to the close of the program. Good to have you with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that.
The book, again, is The Moral Arc, and you can actually meet Michael Shermer this evening. He'll be at Kepler's in Menlo Park, and he'll also be at Book Passage tomorrow and then at Book Inc. on Wednesday. And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, with an hour repeated 10 to 11 in the evening. You can continue this conversation online, kqed.org/forum, and Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Noguchi. And today we have Suki Lewis with us on the controls back there. Our engineer who is on all of the controls is Danny Bringer. Engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks, and senior editor is Dan Zoll. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.